With us, award-winning documentary filmmaker, author, activist who created the Trump Death Clock website and the billboard that's been unveiled in New York City's Times Square. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is working with as few people on site as possible. The majority of our amazing team is working from home. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Harla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Chirina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamarie Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Adriano Contreras, and Maria Tadasena. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Miriam Barnard, Dennis Moynihan, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, David Prude. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closures of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Program Advisory Committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, some Oregon counties are under review for reopening. Nearly 2,000 former officials are calling on Attorney General William Barr to resign, and hate crime charges are being considered in the murder case of Ahmaud Arbery. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, May 11th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. As of Monday afternoon, there are 3,222 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Oregon. There have been 130 deaths in the state. Officials with the Oregon Health Authority reported three more deaths on Monday, a 91-year-old man in Polk County, a 64-year-old man in Umatilla County, and a 77-year-old woman in Washington County. Estimates predict the state of Oregon will see a $3 billion revenue shortfall this fiscal year because of the coronavirus pandemic. Officials also reported 51 new confirmed cases on Monday and 7 new presumptive cases. Amazon said on Sunday that an employee at its massive Troutdale warehouse had contracted COVID-19. This is at least the third case of the virus at the company's Oregon sites. Governors and legislative leaders from Oregon, Washington, California, Nevada, and Colorado sent a letter to congressional leaders on Monday asking for $1 trillion in relief funding for state and local governments. The funding would help the Western State Pact avoid massive cuts to services such as public health, public safety, and education. Nationally, at least 1.3 million people across every state, plus Washington, D.C., and four U.S. territories have tested positive for the virus. At least 80,000 people with the virus have died. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 4.1 million people across 177 countries. As of Monday afternoon, at least 283,700 people have died. According to Governor Kate Brown's office, they have received applications from multiple Oregon counties for reopening after the coronavirus pandemic. This means officials in these counties feel they can reopen some businesses, such as restaurants, salons, and gyms, starting on May 15th. Counties who have submitted Phase 1 applications include Baker, Crook, Curry, Deschutes, Douglas, Gilliam, Grant, Harney, Hood River, Jackson, Jefferson, Josephine, Lake, Lane, Lynn, Malheur, Sherman, Tillamook, Union, and Wallowa. In order to begin the process of reopening, counties must prove that they can meet requirements for declining the spread of COVID-19, a minimum testing regimen, a contact tracing system, isolation facilities, and sufficient healthcare capacity and supplies. Even after some facilities are allowed to reopen, they must follow industry-specific guidelines developed by the state. Oregon Health Authority Director Pat Allen said that more rural counties are much more likely to successfully reopen before urban counties. Counties around the Portland area may have to wait weeks before they can successfully apply to begin Phase 1 of reopening. Law enforcement from the Oregon coast said today that they saw an increase in visitors over the sunny, warm weekend. 700 people were asked to leave Cannon Beach on Saturday and another 60 on Sunday. No arrests were made. While beaches are technically open in Oregon, all public access points managed by the state's Park and Recreation Department are closed until further notice. Several cities and counties on the coast have enacted separate, stricter bans on tourism, including Cannon Beach. Clatsop County Sheriff Matt Phillips said many people had visited beaches throughout the county. He added that small groups and families were doing a good job of distancing from one another, and crowds did not gather at popular access points. Tillamook County Sheriff's Lieutenant Gordon McCraw said the county also experienced an increase in visitors, especially in spots like Pacific City and trails in the Coast Range. He said he was not aware of the sheriff's office having to break up any groups on the beach. State officials are asking people not to recreate with those outside their own households, and for people in urban areas to stay within a 50-mile radius from where they live. On Wednesday, a small group of Oregon State Park sites reopened to the public, following a directive from Governor Kate Brown last Tuesday. Although some parks across the state have begun to reopen, officials say that larger parks, areas along the Columbia Gorge, and beach parks are going to be closed for a while longer. Officials encourage people to practice social distancing and to leave areas if they appear too crowded. Chris Havel of Oregon State Parks urges people to cooperate, saying, quote, "In some cases, it's the parks that are not ready, and in other cases, it's the communities that are not ready. So we really need people to respect those local wishes." Officials recommend that people bring any necessary supplies such as water and hand sanitizer, and reminded people that public restrooms may still be closed in some parks. Parks will continue to reopen based on community readiness to welcome visitors and the preparedness of each park in terms of staff, supplies, and equipment. California's 25th district has a special election tomorrow to replace former Democratic Representative Katie Hill. Plus, Oklahoma's legislature reinstated a notary requirement for absentee ballots after the state Supreme Court temporarily removed it for the pandemic. With more on these stories, it's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
You know, when we think about the national picture and, you know, Trump does very well in rural places and Democrats do very well in urban places, and they kind of fight over those suburban, on the edge of exurban kind of places.
One of those places is the 25th District of California, north of Los Angeles, near where Professor Larry Becker teaches political science at California State University Northridge. The 25th holds an all-mail-in special election tomorrow to replace Democratic Representative Katie Hill. Beating a Republican incumbent in 2018, Hill was a rising star until she resigned from Congress after admitting to an inappropriate relationship with a campaign staffer. About half of America lives in sub- or ex-urban areas, where Democrats have made some gains since 2016 in Pennsylvania, Kentucky, Virginia, and others.
And it's the kind of place that I think Republicans are really worried that they're losing, because that's where the 2020 election nationally is going to be fought, is in places like this. And if they're losing places like this, they're probably, you know, going to lose the election.
Becker thinks that's why President Donald Trump attacked this particular race over the weekend, tweeting that Democrats are, quote, rigging, unquote, the election with the addition of a single in-person voting site in Lancaster, a majority Black and Hispanic city in the 25th district.
Those in-person locations are really essential, especially for voters with disabilities or who have limited English proficiency and who need the assistance in in-person voting, for people who won't receive their mail ballots because they're unhoused or now because they're displaced because of the pandemic.
California League of Women Voters Dora Rose says absentee ballots go through multiple security checks to prevent fraud. California Governor Gavin Newsom announced that in addition to a small number of in-person options in November, all California registered voters will automatically receive mail-in ballots. To vote by mail, Oklahomans have to request an absentee ballot and get it notarized. Oklahoma Supreme Court had ruled to temporarily remove the requirement during the pandemic, but late last week, the Republican-controlled legislature put it back. That's a hindrance with social distancing, according to University of Oklahoma political science professor Tyler Johnson.
You don't live your life thinking about where you're going to be able to find a notary.
Johnson says claims of voter fraud are anecdotal at best in Oklahoma and nationwide, and studies back him up.
On extremely rare occasions, you have these stories where something goes wrong with the process. And then that becomes the example that people use to completely undermine the idea of using this on a wider scale. And those stories are few and far between.
New York's primary is back in question. Citing COVID-19 concerns, the state's attorney general, Letitia Brown, is appealing the federal court decision requiring the state board of elections to hold their primary. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks to Suzanne Potter from Public News Service for sound from the League of Women Voters, and thanks for listening.
Nearly 2,000 former Justice Department officials have signed a letter calling on Attorney General William Barr to resign. The letter, organized by the group Protect Democracy, states that Barr has improperly intervened in the criminal case of former Trump National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. Last week, the DOJ announced it would drop charges against Flynn, who has previously pleaded guilty twice to lying to the FBI about his contacts with the former Russian ambassador during the presidential transition. The letter is signed by mostly former career officials within the department. They accuse Barr of joining with President Trump in, quote, political interference in the department's law enforcement decisions. Barr has denied he was acting at the request of the president when he moved to drop the charges against Flynn. As of Monday morning, a federal judge in the case has not yet responded to the DOJ filing. The letter reads in part, quote, Attorney General Barr's repeated action to use the department as a tool to further President Trump's personal and political interests have undermined any claim to the deference that courts usually apply to the department's decisions about whether or not to prosecute a case. Families and advocates are demanding testing of all incarcerated people and clemency for those most at risk of COVID-19. Andrea Sears has more on that story with the Public News Service.
Formerly incarcerated people and the families and communities of people now in prison held a vigil outside Fishkill Correctional Facility on Friday to demand the release of those most vulnerable to COVID-19. Congregate living quarters and little or no personal protective equipment makes prisons potential hotbeds of coronavirus infections. So far, 85 of those incarcerated at Fishkill have tested positive for COVID-19, more than any other prison in the state, and 5 have died. According to Mark Shervington with the Release Aging People in Prison, or RAP, campaign, the vigil was held in the prison burial grounds to honor the lives of those who have died and to demand action to protect those most at risk.
To grant immediate executive clemency without broad categories of people being excluded based on their crime of conviction, to avoid mass deaths in prison.
Statewide, more than 1,100 prison staff and 415 of those incarcerated have tested positive for COVID-19, but RAP says only 1% of the incarcerated have been tested. Corrections officers now are allowed to wear surgical masks, and the incarcerated population is allowed to use state-issued handkerchiefs as face masks, but Shervington says that isn't enough to stop the spread of the coronavirus.
It's really insufficient, as well as too late. They only recently started doing that after the number of infections among the prisoners and the staff began to rise.
He adds that releasing those near the end of long sentences and those who are parole eligible or already approved for a parole would further reduce the prison population. Shervington says two pieces of legislation, the Elder Parole Bill and the Fair and Timely Parole Act introduced last year in the state legislature, would have made some of the most vulnerable in state prisons eligible for release.
If those bills had been passed during the legislative session, then we would most likely not be in the position that we are now.
On Tuesday, criminal justice reform advocates will gather outside the Edgecombe Correctional Facility to continue their call for clemency for vulnerable prisoners. For Public News Service, I'm Andrea Sears.
Hate crime charges are being examined in the case of Ahmaud Arbery, according to an announcement from the Department of Justice today. Arbery was a 25-year-old black man who was shot to death in February by two white men who had been chasing him in a pickup truck, claiming he was a suspect in a burglary. Public outcry has poured out in response to Arbery's death, eventually resulting in the arrests of the perpetrators some 2 months later. Georgia Attorney General Chris Carr requested the DOJ look into hate crime charges related to the case, as Georgia does not have a state-level hate crime law. He also requested the DOJ look at how the case was handled internally. Carr appointed a new district attorney to oversee the case, making that the fourth one in the case since Arbery was killed. Two of the previous three who were tasked with the case recused themselves, as they had worked with one of the perpetrators who was a retired police detective. The third asked the Georgia Bureau of Investigation to step in once video of the shooting became public. Hate crime statutes make it illegal for someone to enact harm on another based on animus towards a protected class of persons, including by race, religion, or sexuality, among others. If the Department of Justice pursues hate crime charges against the men who killed Ahmaud Arbery and succeed in proving the charge, their sentencing will be much more severe. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for interviews with Multnomah County Circuit Court Judge candidates Rima Gondor and John Slosser. At 6, it's Labor Radio, then at 6:30, Prison Pipeline, and at 7, we'll hear Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with occasional showers overnight and a low of 53. Tomorrow will be rainy with a high of 62 degrees. Today in history, in 1981, reggae star Bob Marley dies at 36 years old in Miami, Florida. Marley performed his last concert at Madison Square Garden in New York City. The quote of the day is from Bob Marley, who said, quote, "The greatness of a man is not how much wealth he acquires, but in his integrity and ability to affect those around him positively." Rock and roll icon Little Richard was confirmed to have passed away on Saturday. KBOO's Melissa Hood has more.
Little Richard, born Richard Wayne Penniman, was an integral force in the invention of rock and roll as a genre. As a child, he sang in a nearby church, but he heard R&B, blues, and country while working at an auditorium concession stand when he was a teenager. After winning a local talent show, Little Richard landed his first record deal in 1951. It was in 1955 that his first hit, Tutti Frutti, was recorded, and Little Richard began his career in rock and roll, quickly rising to the level of other famous musicians like Elvis Presley and Jerry Lee Lewis. His music, attitude, and showmanship continues to influence the music world, and many prominent musicians have credited him as an inspiration, including Prince, Elton John, the Black Keys, Bob Dylan, and the Beatles. In 1986, he was one of the first inductees into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and in 1993, he was awarded a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Grammys. The cause of his death was bone cancer, according to his lawyer. He lived to be 87 years old. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Melissa Hood.
Oglala Lakota community members gather at highway checkpoints, and lawmakers are offering to facilitate talks between tribes in the state of South Dakota. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Community members are gathering at road checkpoints on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota to support border monitors and send a message to Governor Kristi Noem after the governor threatened legal action in a letter to the Oglala Sioux Tribe last week over highway checkpoints. The tribe set up checkpoints in response to COVID-19. Community members, including veterans and members of warrior societies, gathered Sunday at 6 different checkpoints in a show of strength and unity. Davidica Little Spotted Horse was at the West End entrance near Highway 18 by the tribe's casino.
We as Lakota people, we do know our rights and we do know that we live on sovereign territory. And it's extremely important to us. It's something that we're all proud of and something that we do look to for a sense of security is knowing that we have our own laws within our jurisdiction, or within the boundaries we have our own jurisdiction within the boundaries of our reservation, and that we're allowed to govern ourselves that way. So that's something that says security, and we don't take that for granted.
She says throughout the day there were up to 60 people at the west entrance taking COVID-19 precautions, wearing masks, and practicing social distancing. People are planning to continue to assist border monitors throughout the week. Nome is also calling on the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe to remove its checkpoints. Leaders of both tribes are rejecting the governor's request. Meanwhile, the governor is committed to taking the tribes to court over the checkpoints, while some state lawmakers want to help facilitate communication. Lee Strubinger has more.
In a letter to the press over the weekend, Maggie Seidel, senior advisor and policy director for Governor Nome, says the state needs unobstructed access to state and U.S. highways for through traffic. Both the presidents and chairman for the Oglala and Cheyenne River Sioux tribes say they're not only allowing traffic through the reservation, but have consulted with the state about their checkpoints. Seidel says the lawsuit threat by the state comes after hours of communications behind the scenes with tribes. However, they do not consider that as consultation with the tribes. She says no agreement was reached. The state points to a Department of Interior memorandum that states it's unlawful to interrupt the flow of traffic on state and U.S. highways within reservation boundaries. A 1990 ruling by the Eighth Circuit Court finds that, absent tribal consent, the state has no jurisdiction over highways running through Indian lands. Troy Heinert is a Democratic state lawmaker whose district covers the Rosebud Reservation. He, along with four other Native state lawmakers, are asking the governor to let them help facilitate communications with the tribes.
And instead of working with tribes or saying, okay, that's not how we're doing it, but if that's what you guys need to do, then, you know, more power to you. But getting us involved in a, whether it's a lawsuit that I'm tired of paying for lawsuits that the state of South Dakota loses, or creating distrust and animosity, you know, that is not helpful to the greater good either.
Heinert says the state is not recognizing the inherent right of tribal sovereignty handed down by treaty, Congress, and the Supreme Court. He says he hopes the governor gives him a call. For National Native News, I'm Lee Strubinger in Rapid City.
The Board of Trustees and the staff of First Alaskans Institute are mourning the loss of former Lieutenant Governor of Alaska Byron Malott, who passed away last week after suffering a heart attack. Malott held many leadership roles, including founding president of First Alaskans Institute. He's being remembered for his work in public service and in the private sector. He was 77 years old. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The Oregon Zoo in Portland has on display a polar bear sculpture made completely out of trash that has washed up on Oregon beaches. The art piece is meant to educate the public on the dangers of plastic in the ocean. Eric Tegedoff has more on that story with the Public News Service.
Researchers estimate 19 billion pounds of plastic gets into the ocean each year. What washes back to shore could be trash or art. Bandon resident Angela Hazeltine Potsey founded the Washed Ashore Project 10 years ago. She says the nonprofit has worked with more than 10,000 volunteers to pick up garbage from Oregon beaches.
We process that into art supplies in a way that we then turn into the giant animal sculptures of the animals that are threatened by marine debris.
Hazeltine Potsey says they've picked up an estimated 26 tons of garbage and created 80 works of art, including 11-foot-tall penguins and a 16-foot-long parrotfish. The Washed Ashore Project has four traveling exhibits educating the public on the dangers of plastics in the ocean. Hazeltine Potsey says she's a fifth-generation Oregonian and was shocked to see the beaches she grew up on covered in plastic when she moved to Bandon in 2007. That includes a yearly deluge of water bottles from the 2008 Beijing Olympics, which still wash up on the Oregon coast.
Then I found out that the animals are eating it, and it's getting on our food chain, and I was like, I have to do something to save the ocean. This is the most sacred place on earth. We can't be destroying it.
She says people at her exhibits have cried thinking about the scale of the plastic trash issue.
These are beautiful works of art, but it's a horrifying reality that they're all made with garbage picked up off the beaches.
But Hazeltine Potsey notes that people have the power to turn this around. Folks can use reusable bags, coffee cups, and water bottles to start. She says people also can push corporations to change.
We can demand biodegradable materials. We can force our hand as consumers and make changes. It's happened in the past.
The Washed Ashore Project has exhibits on display at the Oregon Zoo, Oakland Zoo, Florida Aquarium, and Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History in Washington, D.C. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Backup power systems at Fort Knox provide electricity, even when regional power is knocked out. Dr. Anthony Leiswitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leiswitz, and this is Climate Connections. An ice storm in 2009 caused the Fort Knox Army installation in Kentucky to lose power for more than a week.
The leadership at Fort Knox decided this will never happen again.
Alex Beeler is Assistant Secretary of the Army for Installations, Energy, and Environment. He says losing power on military bases is not just inconvenient.
It prevents the installation from performing critical missions related to deployment, and if our troops are not able to deploy, they cannot fight, and therefore they cannot defend our country.
So several sites have installed backup power systems to ensure they can remain operational even when regional power goes out. The systems often rely on diesel generators, but Beeler says the Army is also starting to use on-site sources of energy, battery storage, and microgrid technology. Fort Knox now regularly uses geothermal heating and cooling, and natural gas pumped from on-site reservoirs. And when needed, it can operate independently without relying on the grid. So as climate change makes extreme weather more common, Fort Knox will be better prepared. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Lakefront landscaping is key to water quality. With more on that story, here's Current Cast.
Less lawn, more native landscaping for our lakes. On today's Current Cast. You might like the look of a clean-cut lawn, but if you have lakefront property, experts say not to mow all the way to the shoreline.
The most important thing you can do for your lake is to create a buffer zone, and this is a patch of native plants along the lakeshore.
That's landscape architect Fred Rosamulski. He says even modest buffers can trap pollutants such as fertilizers and loose soils before they reach a lake. While the roots of a plant in a buffer zone prevent erosion, the flowers and branches provide valuable habitat for wildlife. And these buffers don't need to keep people away. Grass paths can provide eco-friendly access to the lake. Current Cast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future, supported by New York's Environmental Protection Fund and Sea Grant, online at currentcast.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, May 11th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Melissa Hood and Nat Moon. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Lily Bolke, Eric Tegedoff, Andrea Sears, and Anthony Leiswitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, covering politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist. At 9, Alternative Radio features lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with your host, Dennis Bernstein. At 11, it's Stage and Studio. Host Demay Roberts talks with Laura Loforti, co-director of Vanport Mosaic, about reinventing the month-long celebration into an online virtual festival. And at 11:30, Art Focus features interviews with artists, creators, and critics talking about art, how it's made, and what it means. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from listeners like you. If you'd like to support our programming, go to kbu.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. We will be exploring the Multnomah County Circuit Court Judge Position 12 race with two candidates coming up, so stay with us.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
As the May 19th primary fast approaches, one of the widest races on the ballot is that for Multnomah County Circuit Court Judge Position 12. Interestingly, the Circuit Court has not seen a competitive race for some years, as typically judges are appointed when another resigns and are rarely challenged on the ballot. Today we speak with John Schlosser, who has been a criminal defense attorney for over 10 years with a focus on protecting immigrants and their families, as well as being a board member of Pueblo Unido, a local organization that advocates for the rights of immigrants. Let's listen.
So what inspired you to run for this position?
I mean, as far as this position goes, I'd wanted to be a judge. Didn't always want to be a lawyer. That was the last thing I wanted earlier in my life. But I came to it later in life, and when I was in law school, I was drawn to criminal law. I wanted to be a prosecutor, and I had a mentor who was a judge here in Multnomah County. He'd been a prosecutor, but he and I were pretty similar. He had thought about being a defense attorney first. I ended up being a defense attorney, so we just kind of swapped that way. But when what he would tell me is he was always more satisfied with his job as a judge than he was with the DA. It's not like he felt like he didn't help people there, but he felt like he could help more people. And my whole life, that's what my parents raised me, was service to the community. And so he was always in the back of my mind, wanting to be a judge eventually. Back of my mind for a while. And then a couple of years ago, the judge I really respected retired, Diana Stewart. So I started going through the appointment process and learning more about how the judges would come to take the positions, and how there hadn't been an election for a judicial candidate in well over 10 years. I just promised myself that if a seat ever came open, I'd run.
So you mentioned you worked as a criminal defense attorney, for some years now, and you've also been on the board of Pueblo Unido, a local organization that advocates for the rights of immigrants. What have those experiences taught you, and how would you take those lessons into the judgeship?
The biggest lesson I learned was that, and I think this is something that we all need to learn, but that I learned fairly quickly, let me get back around. About a year and a half ago, I started a different job within St. Helens. But before that, for about 6 years, I was the main public defense attorney for Spanish-speaking people charged with criminal offenses, at least misdemeanors in Multnomah County. So all of my clients, or not all, but 95% were non-citizens or not born here. And what I learned there, and what led me to actually working with Pueblo Unido, was that I have no idea what the person sitting across from me wants or what is most important to them. And I think that's true of any client, but especially when you're dealing with people who come from a completely different culture, that background, you have to put aside what you think would be best for them. Like, I could give them my opinion on what's best for them in the legal case, right? But they might have different opinions about what's most important to them, and immigration status, or not, maybe not. Maybe that's not what's most important to them. I had plenty of clients who I was like, look, let's worry about your immigration consequences, and they're like, no, I don't care. I'm just here to help my family or whatever the case may be. And I learned really quickly not to assume I know what the other person wants or what's best for them, and to work with organizations that are led by, well, at least organizations that work with or for minority groups, that you only work with groups that are led by or staffed by people in those groups.
In your platform, you've expressed interest in restorative justice, which broadly points to rehabilitation of offenders and restitution of harm rather than punishment. What power does a judge have to enact that sort of justice, and how would you work towards that?
Well, by themselves, they don't really have a lot of ability to do that. We're bound by what is in front of us and what options are available. There has to be laws or policies in place to do things. We have those scenarios in Multnomah County, well, in Oregon generally, already. Of them, we have drug courts, health courts, veteran courts, although veteran courts are sad, not nearly as expensive or well flushed out as they clearly should be, in my opinion. But there's always room for more, and trying to reduce recidivism, I think, should be one of the judge's main, if not the main, goal when you are handling a criminal case. And so, in this scenario, to start, what I would like to do is start a restorative justice court, especially court. It would not be something I can do on my own. It's something that I have to get buy-in from the DA's office or whoever the incoming elected district attorney is going to be, and from the defense bar, and the community, for that matter, and victims. Restorative justice court is kind of like a mediation in that you bring everybody to the table, and everybody has to be willing. And you can't have a restorative justice court where a victim who doesn't want to see the person who harmed them, right, it's not going to work. You can't have a restorative justice court where the offender isn't willing to really sit down and open up and make amends. But it's doable, and it's just one of the, I think, the tools and the community's chest of tools towards helping of the bigger picture of restorative justice and helping to heal our communities.
So you spoke to this a little bit, but what sort of structural issues are there in our criminal justice system that pose challenges to restorative justice?
It takes a progressive-ish, I don't know if that's really the right word, but it takes a district attorney's office that is willing to look for new options, right? Willing to take chances on people. And it's not easy. It takes time. And it's a lot easier, I suppose. I'm not putting this on anybody, but I can see where district attorney's office could say it's a lot easier and faster to just roll through cases to the normal plea and sentencing court process, although I don't think that historically the Multnomah County district attorney's office has looked at things that way. You know, we have gold star level drug treatment courts here that courts from all over the U.S. come to shadow to create their own drug courts around. So I don't think that's necessarily a huge hindrance, but it's you know, it's new and it's different, and it'll take time to develop. Funding issues, right? I think that's another big issue, and it goes beyond just the resort discord itself, but, you know, not that there aren't funding issues all over in every department of the government and things like that, but, you know, the courts have historically been underfunded as for the public defense offices, and you, in order to create a court like this, you have to have, you know, funding to do it, and frankly, I think increases in judicial funding should primarily be focused towards expanding the specialty courts that we have already in place in the state, making sure that they are available in every county, fully funded in every county. And for that matter, you have to have a fully staffed, you have a DA's office that's funded enough to staff the position. I mean, Columbia County is a good example. The DA's office there, the only reason they can have a specialty court program at all is they have a grant to pay for one district attorney position. I mean, otherwise, Columbia County wouldn't have specialty courts, and that's scary, right? You have to have buy-in from the defense, from the prosecution, and from the court, and you have to, you know, figure out how to pay for it.
Right. So, to pivot a little bit, you've cited the ban on warrantless ICE arrests in Multnomah County courts as one that you're keen to enforce. Can you tell me a little bit about what the impact of that ban is?
I don't really know yet what the impact is. I haven't heard of any ICE activity in the courthouses since the ban went into effect, but that doesn't mean it hasn't happened, right? I haven't heard of any. That doesn't mean that they're not still enforcing, right? They just shift where they're enforcing. They could still pick people up right outside the courthouse on the, you know, on the sidewalk, for that matter. Keeping them out of the courthouse at least gives a victim, a plaintiff, a defendant, I hope it gives them a little peace of mind that they can get dropped off right out front, be inside the courthouse, and not have to be looking over their shoulder, right? I mean, it's been terrible, the impact of having ICE enforcement going on in our courthouses has had on people's willingness to come to court, people's willingness to testify against their abusers, right? People's willingness to proceed with civil cases, for that matter, against in situations where maybe they're being taken advantage of because they're afraid that something might happen to them. And you know, the court is supposed to be open and available for everybody, and that, I think, is really the heart of Chief Justice Walter's order.
What is one issue in this election that you think doesn't get enough attention?
In this particular election, geez, I don't know. There's not a lot we can talk about. You know, we can't talk about issues, but...
Or maybe something that's, like, commonly misunderstood?
Okay, well, I think one thing that's commonly misunderstood is that judges are, or have to be, maybe, judges have to be... very stoic, rigid, you know, figures, and has to be all this formality and everything. That's not who I am. I'm not hung up on rigid formality. Never have been. I wouldn't be in the courtroom either. It isn't to say, you know, that there aren't rules in place that have to be followed, but for instance, I believe the court, Multnomah County Court, used to have a ban on having hats or headwear in the courthouse. They've modified that now, so it's left up to the judge. I really couldn't care less if somebody was wearing a headpiece, whether it was religious or otherwise, right? I mean, things don't have to be scary and intimidating in the
any closing thoughts for our listeners?
I guess something that I have people have asked me, not in a public forum like this before, but people have asked me why I chose to run in an election again as a white man against with a bunch of underrepresented people on the bench. And all I can say to that is I thought about this long and hard. If it wasn't a white man that was retiring, I wouldn't have run. And I'm not overly vocal about this, but I am a minority member of the LGBTQ community. I don't want people to think that I'm just going to be some old white guy wanting to come in and continue to control the system. Please feel free to email me. I've had people from the community sending emails with questions. This is great in this climate because you can't get out and campaign. And I'm more than happy to have communication if people want.
And what's that email address?
John Schlosser for Judge, which I understand is probably difficult. It's JohnSchlosserForJudge@gmail.com.
Awesome. Well, John, thank you so much for speaking with us today. I appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with John Schlosser, a candidate for Multnomah County Circuit Court Judge Position 12. More information on Schlosser and his candidacy is available at votejohnforjudge.com. Additionally, Schlosser is hosting a Reddit Ask Me Anything session at 6 p.m. this evening with the account at VoteJohnForJudge. Ballots must be sent by mail by May 14th or dropped off at ballot drop-off points by May 19th. For KABU News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
It's a rare occurrence when there's more than one candidate running for a county circuit court judge position. We're lucky to sit down today with one of the candidates for Multnomah County Circuit Court Judge, 4th District, Position 12, Rima Gondor. Rima has been a practicing attorney in both the public and private sectors for 23 years. She worked as a senior counsel with Safeco Insurance and was then a partner at Wiles Law Group. She now runs a certified woman-owned law firm where she takes on a broad range of cases as well as operating in a nearly paperless workspace. Rima is a founding member and former president of the Arab American Cultural Center of Oregon and serves as a board member for the Multnomah County Bar Association. Rima Gondor, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about the responsibilities of a circuit court judge?
This position, Judge Silvers, is a both civil and criminal. You can be in Multnomah County. We do have a separate department for family law and probate and juvenile. But this position generally will be hearing, unless they assist other judges as needed, criminal and civil cases coming in front of the court of all different kinds, broad as you can imagine, whether it's contracts, whether it's personal injury cases, whether it's products liability, whether it's just criminal cases, just everything possible that you hear about somebody bringing a suit, they will be hearing the case.
What are some examples of the cases you're usually working on?
Yeah, so for many, many years, I did a lot of construction defect kind of cases and defending subcontractors and small business owners, and then that included complex business litigation and complex litigation like products liability and those types of cases. In the last 7 years since I opened my own firm, I do a whole array of different cases from both the plaintiff side and the defense side. I do a lot of personal injury cases for non-English speaking clients and clients with that have a hard time finding an attorney, and then I do insurance defense, which means when you get in a car accident, if you're the one who hit somebody, I may defend you, but I do that for small businesses and individuals, not car accident kind of cases. So I do a whole different array. There's been very many different interesting cases that come in front of me having to do with hatcheries and funeral homes and discrimination cases. Just anything you can imagine that somebody will bring a suit in, I've worked in the last 7 years.
You work with plaintiffs and defendants, which gives you a unique perspective of having seen both sides of cases. So why run for this position, and what do you think gives you an edge over the other candidates?
Well, I'm running for this position for several reasons. I do have a broad range of experience. It is in Multnomah County and state court. I do some federal court, but most of my practice is in state court. But the reason I'm running for this position is because I do believe right now, especially now, it is more important than ever to have qualified judges from underrepresented populations. I grew up experiencing war and the scars that can leave. I've lived in a couple countries where I've seen firsthand a lack of justice, equity, and inclusion, and what it can do to both the people and the country. And I down deep believe it is so important to show our community that you don't have to be frightened or intimidated of the judicial system, and that no one needs to forsake their rights because they fear who's going to be sitting at that bench and making judgment on them.
When Kate Brown announced the stay-at-home order, you noticed there wasn't information available for people whose first language isn't English. Share with us a little bit about what you decided to do and about your thought process behind it.
Yeah, it was, so it started with, we had in Multnomah County and other counties, rulings coming out or press releases on what's going on with the court system. And I can tell you, and being on listservs with attorneys, even attorneys were having a hard time understanding or figuring out, like, what will be, you know, is there going to be jury trials? Is there not going to be jury trials? What is going on? And then I'm like, wait a minute, this information is only in English. It is only on the website. Mm-hmm. And if attorneys are having a hard time understanding what's going on, what is everybody else thinking? So I decided to, you know, I speak Arabic. Arabic was my first language. To start doing a couple videos started with the orders regarding the courts, basically me speaking in English and in Arabic to try to get the information, and then gave the Arabic version to different community members with different Facebooks and listservs so that they can share it and people understand what's going on if they have a case going or if they have summons. And then it was the same thing initially. It's much better now. When Governor Brown's orders were coming, again, there was a lack of translation and a lack of spreading it everywhere. That's gotten way, way better, and I keep getting the emails now with different languages and different information. But I did the same thing. So I recruited. I don't speak anything other than Arabic and English and a smattering of French. My husband speaks Spanish. Had a friend translate it for him. So it's, you know, better than just him speaking. And then he did a video. I had a friend who speaks Mandarin, had them do a video just to get the information out, because lack of information results in sometimes hardships and consequences that we all could do without.
Earlier in March, you donated blood, and in a tweet, you wrote something that really stuck with me. You wrote, "There are no acts of support that are too little or too small." Why do you think it's so important to support our community in any way we can?
You can change what's around you by little acts, a lot of little acts, or big acts. And whether it's giving blood or, you know, looking around you and saying, like, wait a minute, somebody's not getting the information they need. That's something to do. I'm part of the Arab American Cultural Center. I'm one of the founders and past president. And actually tomorrow, if any of your listeners need it, we have been shopping and scouring around and finding dry goods, and we have 50 bags that we're going to be giving out, no questions asked, and we hope to keep doing that. That will be at Sesame Donuts downtown. So again, we are all community. We are one. What affects one person in one place, you may not think it affects your neighbor 10 houses down, but it does. And anything we can do will make a difference. And if we all do things, we will make, it'll be waves of difference.
When the Trump administration implemented the travel ban, you stepped up to provide free representation for detained travelers. What made you feel that you had to step up?
You know, I was sitting just like everybody else listening to the news, and you know, your heart is in your stomach and you're like, oh my God, what do I do? And started getting texts and calls from different members of the Arab and Muslim community, because they had my number from the cultural center, saying, hey, my aunt, you know, my one of them, their fiance was stuck in Boston. She was coming. They didn't know what was going. Somebody else was like, oh, my mom is stuck at this airport internationally. What do we do? And I just couldn't sit there and do nothing, or sit there and tweet about it or get on Facebook about it. And contacted another friend of mine, and we're like, what are we going to do? And decided to drop to Seattle, because that's where most of the international flights there. I don't do immigration law, but I can, you know, I can tell somebody you can't talk to this person. I'm representing them if need be. And just to be that act of support with signs. We were on the drive making signs in Arabic, in Persian, in Spanish, you know, calling friends saying, hey, how do we say this? Can we get a printer in Seattle to print those, so that we had signs when we reached the airport? And then once the airport said, the Seattle attorneys took over and handled the Seattle airport, we came back to Portland, and through, whether it's me and several others, started a group of interpreters and attorneys who are willing to go to the airport whenever an international flight has got the schedule, had them go there. Because again, you have to do something. You can't just sit there and worry about it and stress about it, but, you know, or like somebody's effort and not do an effort. If you can do something to change it, do it. If you can protest, go for it. If you are an attorney, go and help. If, you know, you have to, this is our community. These are our citizens, our people.
And you've also done some work with Dreamers trying to renew their DACA applications.
Yes. I don't know how many people have sat and talked to Dreamers and looked them in the eye and listened to their stories, and how much they love this country and how hard they've been working to make sure that they meet every criteria that is thrown at them. And every 2 years, they have to renew their applications, and they have to pay several hundred dollars when they're in school, when they're working, some of them have kids, and they're living in this limbo life, right? Any day, something can change, and it's heartbreaking. So I've done the least that I can do. I can use my legal skills to help them fill the paperwork so they don't at least have to pay for an attorney in addition to everything else they do. And, you know, there's amazing support for that in the Portland legal community, whether through ERCO, whether Catholic Charities. It's very heartwarming to see people come together helping our community.
A big concern for a lot of our listeners is the presence of ICE in our community. You have stressed the importance of countering the fear around ICE raids on courthouses. What could ICE ask of you in the future? And as a judge and a member of this community, where do you draw the line?
Well, I'm very thankful that our Chief Justice Walters has issued an order saying ICE is not supposed to be in the courthouse. And this is, you know, you hear people and it's like, oh, you know what, they're illegal. You know, they're going to come and pick up somebody who's illegal. But people don't think about the families that are shattered with this. But, and then if you are a witness to a crime and you're afraid you're going to get picked up if you go to the courthouse, you're not going to show up. So somebody is not going to get justice because the one witness is not showing up. And there are so many victims, whether domestic violence or human trafficking, who are going to be afraid to step up because, you know, that's one of the threats that's held over them. Is if you complain, we're going to call ICE, right? So they're not going to step forward. So there's so much hardship that comes from taking away access to the courthouses. Just like you would take away access to healthcare, then people are not going to go into the hospitals because they're scared. This is not what this country's about. At least I don't believe so. And we need to protect and make sure everybody is not afraid to take and partake in our justice system.
Rima, do you have any final thoughts for our listeners today?
Sure. I mean, again, I think representation really matters. Who's sitting, making the decisions really matters. What kind of leaders you put in these positions matters. Is it somebody who just does their job and goes home? Is it somebody who goes way beyond what their job is and actually does volunteering and takes active roles in doing what they do? That matters, because we all know we all sit and go, oh, this is not great, but you don't do anything about it. You need somebody who's going to go and look around them and go, what systems do we have that are causing our courts to be inaccessible? What systems do we have that are causing justice to not be served? And look at those and be willing to do whatever it takes, the effort, the leadership to change those. And that's what we need. And we need somebody who's trauma-informed when they're making their decisions and understand that trauma, whatever kind it is, will go on with the person and may affect their behaviors and the outcomes of what is going to happen to them in the future.
You've been listening to an interview with Rima Gondour, who is running for Multnomah County Circuit Court Judge in the 4th District. Please remember to vote in the upcoming Oregon primary election. You can mail your ballot back by May 14th or bring it to any official ballot drop site by 8 p.m. on Tuesday, May 19th. This is Nat Moon for KBOO's News in Depth.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home.